regulators. We regulate defense medical experts and their lies. We're damn good too. But you can't be any geek off the street. You gotta be handy with the cross-exam if you know what I mean. Earn your keep. Regulators! Mount up.
Good morning. It's the Justice Team Podcast, a beautiful Sunday morning in San Diego. We're in the mobile Airstream trailer outside the convention center, talking some shop.
Take me to church, baby.
That's right. I'm
here. Jazzed up here.
I'm Tom Conroy, one of the Toms at the firm. Tom Fair is with me, so we have an extra Tom-filled session today. We've got Grayson Goody with us, and we have Paul Farrell from Green Ketchum Farrell, and is it Tweel?
Yep.
Out of Huntington, West Virginia, absolutely gorgeous country through there if you ever pass through. And I'm going to dive right in because this, I think, is going to be an interesting one. Paul, why don't you tell us what you do and what you have on your plate at the moment in your job, in your role?
Well, jumping right into it, I'm one of the three co-leads for the national opioid litigation that's currently pending up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay, so for those of us who peruse the headlines or we dive in, we've seen that the opioid epidemic, particularly in the Appalachian states, in different parts of the country, that's been big, big news, right?
That's right.
And we have a litigation that I believe commenced in Ohio, and that's the first round of these litigations over the opioid and the pharmaceutical issues, right?
Yeah, so if you think about historically, everybody knows the Purdue story by now. They know the marketing. In 2006, they paid $600 million. So the Purdue story and the Sacklers has kind of played out over the years. But what we didn't know until 2016, when a newspaper publisher in Charleston, West Virginia, by the name of Eric Ayre, E-Y-R-E, he got access to a subset of data called ARCOS, A-R-C-O-S. Mm-hmm. And what he published was the headlines that said 780 million pills were distributed in West Virginia during a period of about 7 years. Now, we only have 1.8 million people in our state.
Right.
Well, Eric Ayre won the Pulitzer Prize in 2017 for his article.
Wow.
Okay. What that started was the idea of there has to be something more to this story. How is it possible that 780 million opium pills were sold in my state, that people are dying and overdosing? It didn't make sense to me. So I started digging into it. And what we found was that in 1970, Congress closed the system of distribution. Now, what that means is that laissez-faire capitalism doesn't apply. You can't play on this playground without Willy Wonka's golden ticket. Now, if you get Willy Wonka's golden ticket, you get to make a whole bunch of money. But there's only so many of them. Now, there's some conditions on the ticket. Number one, only certain manufacturers can make pharmaceutical-grade opium, and they're not allowed to sell directly to the pharmacies. A middleman, a wholesale distributor, gets the exclusive right to sell opium in the United States without going to prison to the pharmacies, and they've got one job. That job is to make sure that the pharmacies are not ordering more than the medical need. Anything that's unusual of frequency, size, or pattern has to be blocked and reported to the DEA.
This sounds like a drug dealer's heaven monopoly.
No question. You can't say it any better. This is so first of all, let's understand about this opium business. It's been around for a while, since the Byzantine era, right? There have been wars conducted in China and all over the world over opium. But not until the American pharmaceutical industry have we gotten to this stage. Because what they did was they isolated the one molecule in the opium plant that's the most addictive and the most euphoric. And then they mass-produced it in the form of a pill, and they sold it across America. So here's what I did. I got to the point where we no longer, and it's really kind of sappy, but I started reading about it, and Barack Obama said something that stuck. He said community problems require community solutions. And I started thinking, well, I'm not going to wait around for the federal government. I'm not going to wait around for Congress or the DEA or my state AGs. I'm going to do something about it in my backyard. So I went to my county commission and I said, you know, there's a thing called public nuisance. Now, for the law nerds out there, everybody remembers from our law school exams, for a private person to file a public nuisance case, you have to have some harm that's separate from the public. Well, what about the public harm? The public has the right to bring the public harm case. So I went to the representative of my local public county commission and said, let's sue the sons of bitches. And then that grew throughout southern West Virginia, southern Ohio, eastern Kentucky, and then everybody else started reading about it. It shows up in the Washington Post. 60 Minutes blows it up. I hire the DEA experts that got run out of town, and all of a sudden the damn thing exploded, and now there's over 2,000 cases from across the country. Approximately 40% of the American population is now represented in this litigation. Every one of the 50 AGs is involved, and we've, for the past 2 years, have been crushing the chain of distribution with documents, testimony. I can't even, some of it's still under seal, and we're in the process in the past 10 days of finally getting it in the public record. And so if you read the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, they're just beginning to crack into what we found.
So I'm just, if somebody wants to, say somebody feels like they're being affected by this opiate crisis that's not in your area or not in your region, how would they get in contact with you, or if they wanted to pursue something like this?
So we're not filing individual cases right now. This is a little different than tobacco. We're not saying that if you are addicted to opioids, you can sue the opioid makers. We've taken a different tact because we're not interested, that's a terrible word, but we're not focused on trying to find a solution by individual. What we're trying to do is take the people, the communities that are paying for the cost of the epidemic to get the resources to make a difference. So what we're attempting to do is we're attempting to take the Arcos data that won a Pulitzer Prize in West Virginia, and we have now made it publicly available to the entire country. And my hope and prayer is that the local media outlets will find the Arcos data we've published and start printing stories about what happened in their backyards.
So, Paul, as I understand it, you know, I've read a little bit in the Post, Washington Post, New York Times, and I think I conceptually understand the pharmaceutical makers, but from what I'm hearing from you is there's a whole chain of people. As they say, the shit trickles downhill, whatever, but there's a whole chain of people involved that are structurally got their hands on this thing. Is that right?
So that's exactly right. What we have done is, I don't know that we've broken the wheel, but we have transformed forever how people will look at the chain of distribution. All controlled 2 and C3 controlled substances have to go through a distributor, and the distributor is supposed to be the pinch point.
They're supposed to be a gatekeeping function.
They are at their TSA.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They get paid a shit ton of money to be TSA, and they haven't done their jobs.
Wow.
You know, you said a few interesting things. This whole thing came to light by this guy publishing some of this Arcos data. And I from what I'm getting from you, that was the tip of the iceberg. Is that accurate?
It was just a crack. It was just a little bit of a ray of sunshine that we looked at and we thought, man, what's going on? So the interesting part of the story is that the reason this newspaper guy got the data is that a local DEA agent gave it to a lawyer who gave it to the newspaper, and it turns out that everybody threw an absolute aneurysm because this data was top secret.
So are we talking about, Paul, there's somebody out there who has their hands around this in real time and they're seeing a problem, and it's one person who decides to effectuate a change that turns into a whole movement? And is that what we're talking about? One guy?
He got fired for it.
Yeah, he had a moment of a crisis of conscience, and he's changed the playing field.
And so what I did, I took that little seed and I filed my case in federal court, which is the opposite of what most people think about when you file a case. You want to be in front of a state court with a judge that's elected. Like in my hometown, my dad's the judge. So you know, it makes sense that I would want to be I filed in federal court because I wanted to serve a subpoena on the DEA.
Wow.
So we fought with them. And so this is a little anecdote. The judge says to me, Paul, you served a subpoena on the DEA. So, yes, sir, I did. They should
Damn
know.
Right, I did.
They should know exactly what these things are about. They should be very familiar with it. So he said, well, why don't you guys get together? So the Department of Justice invited me to come to Washington. Now, I'm just a hillbilly lawyer. So I show up in Washington. You know, hillbilly goes to Washington. And I get to the halls of justice, which aren't that... It's not like Superman and Batman. It's just a big building downtown Washington. And as I'm walking down the hallway for the civil division, half of the offices are in a state of packing, and the other half are in a state of unpacking from the Trump administration coming in.
Right.
Right. So I go into this room, and there's this table that's enormously long, and it's got like 15 lawyers in it. And it's me and one of my buddies. And I'm sitting there, and they said, Paul, we got your subpoena, and you see, this data is not available to the general public. And I said, yeah, I understand. I sent you a FOIA request, and you said no. That's why I served a subpoena. And he said, well, we don't give out this data. It's like, yeah, you've said that. I understand, but you see, this is a subpoena. He goes, well, we don't think we have to respond to it. And I said, well, that's the beauty of it, is you no longer get to make that call. Mm-hmm. You're now in federal court. So I subpoenaed your ass. I want the data. And that's when my buddy says to me, Paul, can we step outside? And so I step out in the hall, and he's like, perhaps you want to lower your tone down. I said, no, make no mistake. These sons of bitches aren't going to cooperate. You know, this isn't like let's be nice and say please. Is we subpoenaed their ass. They're going to turn the records over. So I subpoenaed them. We get to federal court. We have this huge pleading, or this huge hearing, and the judge says, turn the data over.
Yeah.
So, Paul, you've been in discovery, you said, for about 2 years?
Since mid-2018, yeah.
And now, was it just recently that they said it's time to turn the data over?
All right, so this is another interesting little thing. So they, you know, everybody looks at this confidentiality designations, protective orders. Well, these sons of bitches, they stamped every single piece of paper confidential. I have pieces of paper that are blank that have a confidentiality stamp on it.
What's redacted there?
Yeah. And so nothing. It's a blank piece of paper.
Right, exactly.
So I started arguing and saying, look, judge, they've over-designated. I want the confidentiality lifted. And so the other side said, judge, this is a veiled attempt by Mr. Farrell to get these documents in the public record. And I stood up and said, judge, if this is a veiled attempt, I have failed because it's a direct attempt. So nonetheless, the judge said, Paul, it's not time, it's discovery. So I got access to this Arcos data, and I'm able to track every single pill from the manufacturer to the distributor to the pharmacy in America, and I'm nauseous. I'm just sick to my frickin' stomach about it. And if you go back and look at it, I am banging every single day saying to the judge, transparency. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. If you wonder why these guys won't settle, it's because you've blocked and sealed all of their conduct. Open up the court. These are public entities filing public nuisance claims, and the public should be able to see what we're doing. So eventually what happened is... The Washington Post and my local newspapers, the guy that won a Pulitzer, they intervened in the lawsuit. And they went to the judge and they said, for the same reasons you gave the lawyers the data, the papers and media should get it too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the judge said, great argument, but no thank you. So then they appealed to the Sixth Circuit. The interveners did. And so 2 weeks ago, the Sixth Circuit issued an opinion and just... Now, I love my judge, but the Sixth Circuit blasted him and quoted Brandeis in our quotes about sunshine being a disinfectant,
yeah.
Said wow. This is the single greatest... It called this thing a virus and told the judge to release it. And so the judge released it, and then within a few days, the Washington Post was publishing maps that people around the country can click on a county and download the data for their hometown.
Wow. That's so good.
Wow.
That's so good.
That's amazing.
So, Paul, you've got 800 clients about, right? You told us that off the
just
air.
About, yeah.
You mentioned 2,000 cases or litigations going on in the country?
In federal court,
in
yes.
Federal court, okay. Right. So... You told us a little bit about where you are. You think mm-hmm. you might have broken the wheel already in discovery. What's the next horizon? What's coming up over the horizon for you?
So I can't get into a whole lot of detail.
And please don't. Yeah.
Because I've been waiting. I've been waiting for like 18 months to say something. And that's why I kind of came to see you guys.
So these boys have some microphones.
the protective order's been cracked open a little bit.
Yeah.
The next wave that you're going to see is wait till you see the documents. Wait till you see the depositions.
I'll give you my email.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah. So it's Thomas at justiceteam.com, Grayson at justiceteam.com, and Conroy at justiceteam.com.
Actually, send it to my secondary email so that they don't know. I feel a little bit scared for my soul here.
But
it's surferboy86 at yahoo.com.
But I do have some snippets for you, though, if you have time.
Oh, yes. We got time.
Absolutely. Paul, for you, we got time.
Absolutely.
All right, so one of the things that happened was we've been waiting for the dispositive motions, and I said, look, now that we're filing dispositive motions on the open record, anything that gets filed is open record. And so the judge said, yeah, Paul, you're right. So we filed a motion for summary judgment, and we attached 580 exhibits.
Oh my God. Wow. I love that.
So we would cite one sentence in a transcript of a deposition, and then we would include all 3 days of the deposition. Well, the other side was not happy about it.
Yeah.
So we've been but nonetheless, about half of the stuff is still under the way that I've described it. It's like having all this furniture in a huge warehouse, and there's a sheet over every piece of furniture, and there has to be a compelling need for the sheet to remain. And so far, we've removed about half the sheets. And the stuff that I can talk about is the stuff that the sheet's been removed. And there's still another half of stuff that the sheets are over that they'll go down fighting before that comes out.
Right, I imagine.
So one of the things we found is that the country's largest manufacturer, Mallinckrodt, they made about 38% of the pills in America. There's an email exchange between them and one of the distributors. And the distributor says, hey... we need more pills. We can't keep them in stock. It's like they're addictive or something. ... Wait, it's opium.
Or something.
And so the manufacturer responds, it's just like Doritos. Keep eating, we'll make more.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Which is the opposite of what they're putting out into the public, is they're saying, oh, right. This stuff's not addictive. It's going to help you with your pain. Don't even worry about it.
But more importantly, it's completely and directly contrary to their statutory obligations as the gatekeeper. It's the whole reason we created a closed chain of distribution.
Wow. And you know, sure enough, the one, you know, safety mechanism is completely out of whack and dysfunctional and doing the exact opposite that they're supposed to be doing.
That's right. You got to wonder how deep this really goes. Like Tom was saying, you know, where does it all end? Do you ever get worried? Do you ever get concerned for your safety? Maybe this goes even into the government. I mean, I'm concerned. I'm concerned because this is a huge issue.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, and Paul's going to say, drop an F, no. I'm Paul. I'm the hillbilly lawyer. You know where I am.
So that is true. Listen, if something happens to me, then I got brothers back in West Virginia that are meaner than me. And so I ain't afraid of any of them. And if something does happen, by the grace of God, then, you know, John Grisham will have a very nice book to write.
Right. But, so, Paul, long view of this. You know, we're pursuing the companies, the distributors. We're trying to address the harm done to communities. what meaningful change are we hoping to affect by this? Are we trying to rework the distribution framework? Are we trying to larger picture establish that big companies can't do this kind of stuff?
All right, so let's talk about a little bit of context. We were able to release the national data that established in a 6-year window. They sold 78 billion pills in America.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about that number, right? 1 million seconds is 16 days. 1 billion seconds is 33 years. We sold 78 billion pills of opium in America.
That's
and now
crazy.
We're wondering why we have an opium problem.
That is crazy.
Right. So some people were trying to say that this marketing by Purdue raised the sea level by a few feet in America of the amount of opium being prescribed. And what I've been trying to communicate, this isn't a sea level rise. It's a frickin' tsunami. So when you chart the data in 1998 when OxyContin launched for opium in the form of a pill in America, and then you look at the sales that go for the next 15 years, it literally looks like a tsunami wave, right? So the level of penetration in America is beyond what anybody has ever grasped. So what I'm trying to effectuate is some change. And I've kind of broken it into three things. Everybody have seen the video games with the viral outbreaks, or if you think about the influenza A epidemic in 1918, if there was a zombie viral outbreak right now, what would we do in America? Right? The first thing we would do. So we've got a history. We know what we would do. We would try to contain it, right? People would be wearing masks on the subways. In New York, they shut down the school systems and the churches and the subways to try to contain the viral spread. Because as long as the virus spreads, you're just counting bodies.
Right.
So to contain this outbreak, we have to get a hold of the pills. We have to return the volume of pills back to 1998. Right? We have to stop newborn babies from being born addicted to opium. We have to stop the epidemic of grandparents raising grandchildren because there's a missing generation addicted to opium. If and when we can contain the outbreak and stop creating more zombies, then we can move on to step two. And that is, what do we do once we've contained the outbreak? What do we do to keep our families safe while it rages? Right? That's going to require an investment in law enforcement. It's going to require us to figure out what to do with babies that don't have places to go, the judicial system, the drug courts, probation, you know. But so if we can contain the outbreak and we can keep our families safe while it rages, then and only then can we figure out what to do with health care and how to treat those that are addicted and how to account for this multi-generational problem.
Wow. Paul, we got flashed the time by our executive producer director. I think we could probably spend a comfortable 4 to 8 hours talking to you about this.
Stay tuned.
Looking forward to it. Paul Farrell, Green, Ketchum Farrell, and Tweel, Huntington, West Virginia. Paul, you've got an open invite to return to the podcast anytime you want. Next time you're in Southern California, everybody out there who might catch this at a later date, look out for Paul, the self-proclaimed hillbilly lawyer, but I think he's anything but. I think that's just his shield. He comes through the door as a hillbilly
lawyer. Pow,
pow. He comes through the door as a hillbilly lawyer, but by the time you catch on, boy, you're in trouble. But the adversaries, I mean. But anyway, for Tom Fair, Grayson Goody, I'm Tom Conroy. Paul, we can't thank you enough.
Thank you, Paul.
Best of luck, your work.
Thanks,
best of luck.
Best
we'll be looking
luck.
Out for you.
SLG, it's in the Omni report. Opinions all week. All you insurance doc hacks are about to see. So I took the report and went right through it. I grabbed the mic and said, let's do this. You seen the MRIs and said nothing's up. Yet I know lying is how you make your bucks.
Doc is a sleaze and also a perv. Straight face at the disc, never hit the nerve. Forget the treating docs, this a classic trick. Paid to say the disc is normal and shouldn't be fixed. I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I need to expose this crooked doctor's wealth. Insurance every time, surely the next. Paid millions to lie about injuries of either sex. My client's diagnosed, doc's acting a clown. Says it's all a sprain and lose a few pounds. Claims no nerve compression when doc was around. Even though the pain radiates all the way down. Doc says it's in his head, somatoform sound. Even through the Mullinger theory.